Welcome to the Shift Extension Paramedic Podcast. Matthew Wilkinson Stokes, how are you, my friend?
Mate, I am good. I'm going great. What's news?
Ah, living the dream. You're back for another episode of What Would You Do If? Which is just awesome. I think this is our sixth or seventh episode of this kind of theme, and I'm really enjoying the questions you're posing and throwing at me. It's great. It's made me think. I've had to do some research. You know,
mate, I'm just trying to keep you on your toes.
It's good. You know, my brain's atrophying, and it's in my 30s. Matt, we're back today. We're doing something a little different. We've spoken a lot about clinical topics, trauma and dysrhythmias, and I think there was some respiratory stuff in there, but I think today we'll do something a little different. We're going to talk about what would you do if your patient doesn't want to come to hospital?
Yeah, and mate, the title for this one is going to be what would you do if ... your patient says, "Nah, mate, I'm good." Which is probably what they seem to say to me the most. "Nah, I'm good. No, I'm all right. No, it's okay.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, this is a good one. I think this is something that many paramedics deal with on a regular basis, irregardless of whether you work in a jurisdictional service or in the private sector. Matt, when you were at university, how often did you do a scenario or cover off in your training a situation whereby your patient would refuse to come to hospital?
So I can answer that. Mine was never, because the area, the service I grew up in, didn't have a guideline for non-transport at that time. So it was literally just not taught to us at all in any way, shape or form. And I remember when I moved up to my current service, which does have, you know, formal guidance on what to do in a non-transport scenario, I was just gobsmacked. I was thinking, wow, this is crazy. I've never heard of capacity of, you know, trying to assess if someone's been, if their information's voluntary, if they understand everything. It was all completely new to me. So I found this really super interesting.
I think it goes back to the crux of what we do, which is pre-hospital medicine, whereas we expect that our patients in their interaction with us will eventually go to a hospital. But we're finding now then that, especially now in 2024, that a hospital isn't necessarily the right place for a lot of these patients. Whether we decide that it's not the right place or a patient elects not to go for various reasons. And that's what we're going to discuss today.
Yeah. And, you know, I was chatting with one of my mates just last week who's in a different area to where I work. And where I work, the culture is kind of, you know, most people get taken to hospital. And if you've got a good reason not to, that's fine. But you kind of assume that the majority of people go to hospital. My mate was telling me that the ambulance service that he works at, there's an absolute assumption that you wouldn't take someone to hospital. And you have to essentially prove why that person needs to go to hospital in your paperwork. It's almost the exact opposite. It was really interesting. So I definitely see this being more of a thing in the future as well.
100%. I think over the next 5 or 10 years, we're going to see, you know, and we'll talk about it today. It's not about should they go to hospital. It's more about what care do they need. Is it a hospital or is it an alternative pathway?
Mate, what I'm going to do today is I'm going to toss one kind of generic, easy, straightforward scenario at you. And then I've got three ones where I kind of twist it a little bit, make it a little bit more juicy. See how you go.
Okay.
So our initial straightforward scenario is you go to a middle-aged guy. He's diagnosed with cardiovascular disease. He's experiencing angina. His partner's called 000. You get there and all his vital signs are normal. ECG's normal. Everything's normal. The pain's resolved. You explain that he, you know, probably needs a blood test to look for troponins XYZ. And he says, "No, thanks. No, I just don't want to go to hospital. I'm happy to stay here." That's a relatively straightforward case of someone should probably go to hospital, but they don't want to. Where do you start, mate? How do you approach this?
I think there's two steps or two considerations we need to go through or work through when we're presented with this kind of situation. So we've got a gentleman who has risk associated with his presentation. He's had some chest pain. He's got high blood pressure, high cholesterol. He's a smoker. and we want him to have some assessments done at hospital to kind of rule some stuff out. We think that that's the best place for his journey. Now, there's two things that we need to start considering when we get that response from the patient of, nah, she'll be right. No, thank you. I don't want to go. Well, the first thing that we need to consider is, does my patient fully understand what I'm telling them? Do they fully understand the information that I am providing to them in relation to their presentation today? Now, that goes or links back to what we do as paramedics and what our role really is, which is to gather a whole lot of information, align that next to our knowledge, and then come up with some form of impression about what is going on with the patient or what could be going on with the patient. Now, the next step to that is providing a recommendation of care to the patient. So for this guy, a recommendation of care or our impression of the patient is that he possibly has acute coronary syndrome. And our recommendation of care is to attend a hospital whereby he can have a blood test to look at troponin, but also have some additional tests to look at differentials for chest pain, such as a chest x-ray, might get an ultrasound of his heart. They might do some inflammatory markers or look for infection or other things like that. But he needs some further assessments done that we can't do on scene that can get done in a timely manner at a hospital. So that's our impression. That's our recommendation of care. But we need to make sure that we are communicating this recommendation of care clearly to the patient. So that's the first thing. Have I expressed that recommendation of care in a clear manner, in a manner in which the patient will understand, free of jargon, free of lingo, that reflects the patient's own health literacy?
Absolutely fantastic, mate. And if your guy says, yeah, I get you, I understand what you're saying, but no, mate, I'm all good, where do you go from there?
I think from there you look at another issue that is commonly seen in patients who are refusing hospital transport or further treatment. And that really is there a barrier to accessing that care? Is there something else going on that's stopping them wanting to take on your advice and recommendation? And a lot of the times, if we can identify that and if we can resolve it and overcome that barrier, then the patient will agree. Now, I'm going to use the example of, there can be lots of examples actually. You know, it might be, I have a cat and the cat needs to be fed in the morning. And if I'm not here, the cat doesn't get breakfast. Or it might be, I need to pick up my kids from school. Or it might be, I have an appointment or I got a new job. My boss is going to, you know, be upset with me if I don't turn up. So there's all these barriers where the patient perceives that those barriers are more significant than the risk of not getting care or the benefit of getting care. So what we need to do is help that patient overcome those barriers. Can I go knock on the patient's neighbor's door and say, hey, can you come feed the cat? Or can I ring your auntie, your uncle, or organize someone to come and pick up the child from childcare? Or can I ring your boss for you and explain the situation? What can I do to help overcome the barriers that are stopping you from accessing that care? And then you're more likely to engage in that care.
Absolutely awesome. And to, if they go, no, I hate whatever, the hospital or something, I just refuse to go to hospital. Do you look at different alternatives? Do you come up with other ideas? What's your approach there?
Yeah, so I think if you get to that point, and I think a lot of the time where your patient is refusing, if you can break down those barriers and if you explain things really well in words and terminology that the patient understands, balancing that against the risks of maybe not getting that care, I think a lot of the times patients will engage and will follow your recommendation. They generally do. They, once they understand and they really trust you, and there's a lot of trust in the relationship between you and your patient, a lot of the time they will get on board and follow your recommendation. But occasionally it doesn't happen. I think this is rarer than we maybe think. But it does happen. Sometimes patients just say, no, I don't want to go. I hate this hospital, or I hate this doctor, or I had a bad experience before. Now, we can work with that a little bit. We can mold it and say, okay, well, maybe we go to a different hospital, or, well, that doctor you dealt with doesn't always work there, and I know the team there today is really good, and they can look after you really well. You can mold that a little bit, but sometimes patients are just like, no, I don't want to go. Now, what we can do in those situations is look at alternatives. So let's go back to your gentleman who's got chest pain or might be resolved chest pain. We want to get some blood tests done. We want to get a chest x-ray and ultrasound and all that. Now, you can get a troponin test from a GP. You can get a chest x-ray ordered from a GP, right? Is that the primary preference? No. But will they get that assessment? Yes. At some point, it'll take longer, but they're still getting that assessment. So what you need to do in these situations is look at alternatives that may not be as good, but can still provide something to their patient, okay? And see if the patient will engage in that. So it's that idea of best, better, good. Have you heard of that idea before?
Mate, that's totally new to me, but it makes perfect sense, right? Which is, you don't offer one option and they go, all right, in that case, there's nothing. Yeah. You try and get them something.
It's like, for example, I'll use the analogy of cleaning a wound, right? The best thing you can use to clean a wound is saline, right? That's best. Better is water that's been boiled, and good is water from a bottle, right? That's how, or be water that's been purified in some other way, okay? We can't always do the best, but sometimes there are alternatives that can still provide some benefit to our patient.
Mate, absolutely brilliant. All right, so there's a good generic scenario. Now I'm gonna toss a couple of little twists into the scenario.
Okay.
I'm gonna give you a scenario which I vaguely based on something I went to a little while ago, which is you go to someone with, you know, undifferentiated abdominal pain, something like that, something that's quite tricky. It's 10 out of 10 pain. You pop in an IV. You give them some morphine, and 30 seconds after you give them the morphine, they say, all right, you can leave now. I'm going to stay here. Thanks. You've been taken for a run. They just wanted that hit of morphine. What do you do? How do you manage that situation? You've just given them a Schedule 8 medication, potential side effects associated with that. They've got an IV line sitting there, and they're now refusing any further treatment or care. Mate, how would you handle that situation?
Oh, it's an interesting situation. I think you first start off with explaining about why you would not want to continue the recommended care after receiving something as significant as intravenous analgesia. That's quite odd to me. And, you know, from there you go, well, it's about explaining to the patient that, okay, you've had some morphine, you feel better, but we're not fixing the cause here. You're going to, once that morphine wears off, we're going to be back to where we were, right? So, unless we go and try and figure out what the cause is, we're just going to be back here in a few hours' time in the same situation you were in before we got here. So that's an interesting kind of area that you would need to explore with the patient. I think there's some misconceptions around certain drugs we carry, especially around the scheduled drugs, that if a patient has been administered certain drugs, that they must go to hospital. And this is incorrect. It's a misconception. There is nothing anywhere that says that if you receive specific drugs, you must be conveyed to a hospital. Right? The reason why we want to is because when we give certain scheduled drugs, there is obviously a potential benefit, which is why we give the drug, but there's also risks associated with that. So, for example, you've popped a cannula in, you've given someone some intravenous morphine. There are risks associated with that, such as hypertension, can cause some respiratory depression, some ALOC as well. So we want our patient to go somewhere whereby we can continue to monitor them for those risks and then be able to manage those if they do pop up. Now, there's nothing, you can put a cannula in someone, give them some morphine, and if they say, nope, I'm not going anywhere, there's nothing you can do about it, and they flatly refuse. I can't force that person to go anywhere. There's no legislation, there's no law that says I can force that person to go to a hospital.
That's absolutely perfect, and that is what I slowly and painfully came to realize when I was on scene with that patient, was I can't make someone do something just because I want them to do it. Anyway, it's an interesting situation. Here's another one for you, mate. You go to someone where you're just not sure of their capacity. Now, you mentioned before that they need to be able to understand what you're telling them. we go to a lot of people who might have varying ability to understand. And I want to toss out three scenarios to you. First one is someone who's drunk. Let's say not totally, you know, catatonic, obviously incapable of anything, but someone who's in that moderate tipsy category. Second one I want to ask you about is someone with dementia or some level of intellectual impairment. And the third one I want to ask you about was another case I vaguely went to, a teenager where the parents are saying one thing, but you've got an older teenager saying another thing and how you resolve that. Let's run through those three when you're not sure about capacity. Drunk people, what's your general approach to capacity in intoxicated people?
Well, they're three really good examples of situations where you'd be a bit dubious about someone's capacity to make a decision. But let's talk about capacity quickly, right? So for someone to refuse and it to be a valid refusal, they need to have the capacity to do so. Therefore, they need to be of sound mind to be able to make sound decisions. And there are situations whereby either through disease or substance or acute illness, hypoxia or hypoglycemia, where someone's ability to make decisions and have capacity to refuse a recommendation of care isn't present, or it's affected, right? So part of our job is to assess our patient's ability to have the capacity to refuse our recommendation of care. And that's a really challenging thing to do sometimes. It's very gray. It's 43 shades of gray, right? So I'll use your example, your first example of the person who is intoxicated. Now, I would love to hear people's opinions of this, but my feelings on it is that just because you've had something to drink doesn't mean you automatically no longer have a capacity to make decisions for yourself. What do you think, Matt? If I have one beer, have I lost all capacity to make good decisions?
Look, having followed your life for a little while now, there's been very few good decisions made at any point. So I don't know if we really got a good baseline here. I don't think the alcohol is going to, it might make it better. I don't know.
Maybe we need to go have some beers and, you know, for research purposes, of course.
Yeah, determine where the cutoff point is.
Can we get a grant?
That is a genuinely... That is a freaking interesting paper idea, isn't it? What level of blood alcohol intoxication correlates with a loss of capacity to make an informed decision? So interesting, right?
We need to get a grant. We need to go to ethics, and you need to change the topic of your PhD.
Oh, my God. I want to say, guys, I need some money. It's for Cooper's Pale Ale.
I found a new great beer. It's up from your way. Noosa Heads Black Lager.
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. Good. I mean, look, Uni Melbourne are pretty cool, but I don't know if they're that cool.
Okay, we'll
be pushing them to the limits.
Right. If anyone out there would like to do some research and is looking for a research topic, please write to us and we'll guide you in the right direction over a beer. So do you think that someone loses their capacity as soon as they have something to drink?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
So I think the capacity thing, it's not a binary decision. It's not they do that or they don't. Capacity, you have to incorporate the risk of not accessing care based on your impression of the patient. So let's say, I'll use two examples. Let's say I'm intoxicated. I'm heavily intoxicated. And I've cut my finger. The risk of not accessing that care right now is pretty low. So I don't have to really demonstrate a lot of capacity because there's not a lot of risk associated with not accessing care, right? Versus I drank too many beers, I fell over, I smacked my head, I was unconscious, I seized for a bit, I woke up, I was a bit agitated, and now I'm slurring my words and I've got a big boggy mass on my head. There's a lot of risk there. Right? So I would have to demonstrate an incredible amount of capacity to not be able to have a valid refusal of that care. So when it comes to intoxication, any cause of potential impaired capacity, you've got to balance it against the risks of not accessing that care. And again, that's a really tricky thing to do. And there's no textbook manual or anything that's going to be able to give you a clear and cut answer on that.
Mate, that's a really good answer. And look, I think that one really applies pretty well to the second scenario as well, the dementia or intellectual impairment one. Did you have any extra bits you want to add into that one? Because I feel like you've covered it pretty okay.
You see, these patients, these dementia patients, you think of them as red flags. So if someone has called you and they're saying that they're demented, partner, loved one, friend is acutely unwell and has a change in their cognition, that's a red flag to me. That person is, their baseline is an impaired cognition. And now something's happened that's changed that, that's made that person so concerned that they've engaged healthcare. That to me is a large red flag, right? And in that cohort of patients, because a lot of dementia patients, not all, you can get dementia when you're young. A lot of dementia patients are older, therefore they're more comorbid. Therefore, they're more at risk of getting serious illness. So things like headaches, abdo pain, back pain are far more likely to be malignant or more significant causes than benign causes that you see in younger people. So the risk is higher. So you have to demonstrate more capacity. So they already have impaired capacity. They have new impaired capacity and they have a lot more risk. All right. So that's a challenging one. Now, what was the third one you mentioned?
So what you would do in that scenario, because that was actually a really neat little bit of info you just tossed out there, is the more of those kind of red flags and risk factors, the more strongly you're going to want to be convinced, I guess,
yeah,
for lack of a better word. The third scenario I had was a teenager. I had a 17-year-old and the parents say, hey, I want her to go to hospital because of X, Y, and Z. And she said, I'm not going to hospital. And after a bit of to and fro, I did not take her to hospital. Still a little 50-50 on that one. What are your thoughts on that, just without even knowing anything about the case, just based on those facts?
Yeah, so this comes down to, it's an idea of Gillick competency, which is the set of principles about judging someone who's under the age of 18, their capability to make independent decisions for themselves.
Mate, for those of us who didn't graduate law school, can you just summarize Gillick? What are you talking about there? What's the idea here?
Let me quickly Google Gillick. It's been a while.
I think let me toss out to you my vague
all
recollection,
right,
from years ago.
We got it here. I've Googled it.
What I've got in the back of my mind was basically that competency isn't something where you turn 18 and suddenly you become automatically competent. That's pretty intuitive to all of us. It's a slow learning process. And that learning generally occurs somewhere in the later end of the teenage years. And you can say that someone who is legally underage is competent to make their own decisions if they demonstrate their competency to you. And there was a case with someone called Gillick who ended up in that situation. And I can't remember whether they were like 15 or 16 or something like that. And they were determined that they did have legal competence. So someone who's under the age of 18 who does have the ability to make their own decisions is referred to as being Gillick competent. Is that, I've just kind of winged that a little bit. You've got Wikipedia open. Do you want to jump in and fix up the bits where I've gone wrong?
I like it. I do like it. It came from the UK in 1986, which was around
the UK. I didn't even know that. There you go.
Yeah, the House of Lords in Gillick versus West Norfolk, where a mother of girls under 16 objected to the Department of Health's advice that allowed doctors to give contraceptive advice and treatment to children without parental consent. And the decision was that a child under 16 has the legal competence to consent to medical examination and treatment if they have sufficient maturity and intelligence to understand the nature implications of that treatment. So essentially, if you're under the age of 16, even though you're considered a minor, you can make independent decisions about your healthcare needs if you can show a level of maturity and insight into that. And those minors are
absolutely phenomenal.
Gillick competent. There you go. Quick law lesson. That's about it. I've got to Google this stuff, man. I can't remember it. People think that because you've been a paramedic for a long time, you remember lots of stuff, but I just feel like you forget as much as you remember.
Yeah, the more time I spend with you, the more I feel like it's almost the opposite. You you actually remember very little in the way of raw facts, but your ability to intuitively judge a situation goes through the roof and becomes incredibly good. It's a bit of a trade-off.
Yeah, this is why we don't talk about pathophysiology on the podcast. I don't remember half.
Yeah. Now, very last scenario I want to toss out for you. Third and final scenario. You're on the scene and someone, you know, you've got a decision that needs to be made. You've got a person who doesn't have capacity and someone else who's there says, I'm allowed to make that decision for them. I am their enduring power of attorney. I have a copy of an advanced care directive. I'm their guardian. I'm their next of kin. I'm their partner. How do you approach those situations? How do you work out if they're allowed to or not? And what kind of documentation do you need to see?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. So in Australia, there's a whole bunch of different forms that essentially exist, or the pieces of legislation, I should say, which essentially creates a mechanism whereby a person that isn't a patient can make decisions about their healthcare at certain times. So there's different things, like you mentioned, the power of attorney. There's things like advanced health directives or statement of choices. There's the Guardianship Act and next of kin. They're the kinds of terms that get thrown around, and we'll briefly talk to each of them. I can't comment on every state in Australia. I can't comment on how things are done overseas. I would suggest that most Western healthcare systems, they're very similar. They might just have different names. So we'll start with power of attorney. So a power of attorney is someone that's been legally appointed to make decisions on behalf of someone in regards to anything. So it could be like legal matters, medical matters, you know, a mortgage, a sale of a property, stuff like that. When the person is no longer able to make decisions for themselves. So for example, I'm my parents' power of attorney. They're quite healthy, well, and in their 60s. But I can't make decisions for them. Let's say they became acutely unwell. They end up in intensive care and they lost that capability to make decisions. I, as their appointed power of attorney, can now step in as their substitute decision maker in that time. So it's a legally appointed once that person has lost that capability. Right? An advanced healthcare directive or a statement of choice is essentially something, it's the patient saying how they would like to be cared for once they lose their capacity to make decisions, or they can't make decisions for themselves, or they're near the end of their life. So it's kind of like pre-planning or forward planning about what may or may not happen in the future. So you see this a lot with people with lots of comorbidities, where they're expected to die within 1 to 2 years, or patients who have, you know, advanced terminal illness as well. So that's the patient's wishes on paper. It's not the wishes being made by a separate person, like in a power of attorney. Does that make sense?
Mate, that's fantastic.
Now, guardianship. Sorry, you go.
Oh, no. I was about to ask about that. So
a guardianship.
Go for it.
Is a guardian is a legally appointed person under the Guardianship Act, which is someone who can make decisions about someone else's healthcare, where when that person has an ongoing inability to make decisions for themselves. So they have like an intellectual disability or an acquired brain injury. They're under full-time care. They've had a significant stroke. They're a minor. They have significant psychological illness whereby they don't have ongoing sound mind to make decisions for themselves. So they're appointed a legal guardian. And you see this a lot in persons who are under state care as well, whereby they require a lot of assistance to go about their daily lives, and they have an appointed guardian that can make decisions on their behalf in relation to a lot of things, including medical decision-making. Now, the one thing that gets thrown around is this kind of idea of next of kin. You've heard of this, Matt?
I have. I've heard people say it, and I've been confused about what the actual relationship is.
Now, do you think next of kin has any legal backing?
Look, I'm assuming not, but I don't really know.
Well, Matt,
which is, I guess, why I'm asking you. What is it? I don't know. You tell me. What are we doing? Why am I answering the questions? I asked the question. I'm the one who asked.
I like to think of this as a collaborative podcast. You've assumed, right, Matt?
Mick gives information, I give misinformation.
No, you're just keeping me on my toes. You're right. Next of kin has no legal framework. It's just, it's any person that you put down. It's an informality of someone you can call if something happens. Like you see it when you go on holidays or sign up for travel insurance or get a new job. It's just something on paper. It has no legal capability. So if you go to someone, they're like, I'm their next of kin, I want you to do X. Well, okay, I don't really think that has a lot of standing. They can't force you to do it. You know, this stuff's challenging to navigate, and it's even more challenging to navigate in a time-pressured sense. So, Matt, have you ever walked into a cardiac arrest and someone's like, at a nursing home, or they're old and they're in a...
Once or twice.
They're in a hospital bed and, you know, you're like, do I want to really resuscitate this person? Is it within good medical practice? Someone that might identify themselves as a power of attorney. Like, how do you navigate that situation?
Mate, it's a tricky one. I always, if I'm on my way to an arrest, when I'm dispatched to it, I generally ask the dispatchers over the radio if they're aware of a power of attorney. Sometimes they've gathered that information during the initial triple-zero call. So when we walk in the door, we can have it. The other thing I do is we're really, really lucky where I work to have access to patients' medical records. I know most paramedics around the world do not, but I'm, depending on the time it takes to get there, also normally given a patient's name and date of birth, and I can actually look up their medical record, and that normally includes advanced care directive for whether or not they're for resuscitation. And if they're at a nursing home, in my experience, the nurses are really pretty good at knowing that that's the most important piece of paper you're going to want regarding someone who's peri-arrest or in needs resuscitation, is having that ready to go. As a general rule of thumb, if there's any uncertainty, I'd probably be in the category of start, ask for that paperwork, ask for some proof. And if you've got it there, it's okay to stop. And if I'd need to check what my actual rules say to be 100% correct, but if you're in, you know, a family situation, someone's palliative, they tell you hand on heart, yes, you know, they're a palliative blah, blah, blah patient, they've got an advanced care directive, I'd probably be willing to take that at face value. I'd probably be willing to take that on good faith. But I'm aware that's a little bit risky. So I might have to look up what my own organization's rules are about that after this. How about you, mate? Do you agree with that? Anything you disagree with? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, you can take a bit of information as face value. And I know we're a bit off topic here. We're talking about, you know, cardiac arrest and things, but you take it with a grain of salt. You know, the person doesn't have to produce a big piece of paper and put it in front of your face for it to be valid necessarily. And I think we're really lucky in... We work in a system whereby we can access this stuff digitally now, which is fantastic. But I'll say this, if you're unsure, ask for help. And this relates to both, you know, some decision-making around alternative decision-makers or what we were talking about before with regards to, you know, the patient who doesn't want to go to hospital. You don't need to make these decisions by yourself. Get some buy-in from someone else. And ideally, someone more senior. It might be your partner, you might phone a friend, you know, get some help in making these decisions. Someone said to me years ago is that, you know, a decision made by multiple people is always more powerful than a decision made by one person, right? So think of it as if someone's going to look back and go, well, was it the right decision? They will probably more likely say that it is the right decision or be less wary of the decision made if it's made collaboratively by a team. So whenever I have something a bit sticky or challenging or a bit unsure, or the implications of that decision are quite high, like the outcome of that decision is quite high, I'm more than happy to go and ring someone else and get someone else to buy into it so we can do it together. If we do it together, the decision is more likely to be the right one. The meme.
Mate, I think that pretty much wraps it up for the scenarios that I had and the questions that I had. But while we're chatting about non-transport, do you have other things that I haven't asked about that are important, things you think people should know or that I haven't mentioned?
I think also if you are in a situation whereby, you know, your patient doesn't want to engage in the care that you provided and you've gone through all those things we've talked about, about making sure they understand the information that's being provided to them. We've broken down barriers. We've looked for alternatives. We've gone through all that. Patient still doesn't want to go. That's okay. We have to accept that people can make decisions for themselves, and we don't have to agree with that. Just because we think it's not the right decision doesn't mean that patient isn't entitled to make it. We don't have to agree. Patients have a right to refuse healthcare. And there are situations where patients have a right to refuse healthcare, knowing that by doing so, it's likely to cause them harm and or death, right? And we have to respect that sometimes. So there are situations where sometimes you leave people at home and then they go on to die, and that's okay. We just have to make sure that decision's the right one. And I think in those situations where we're providing advice to these patients, we need to also make sure that they understand that advice. They understand the risks as well about not making it. Don't just say, oh, if you don't go to hospital, you're going to die. That's a bit, you know, that's a bit vague. It's a bit fear-mongering.
It's a bit reductive too, isn't it?
We are smart people. We can be a bit more intelligent than that. You know, let's be a bit more nuanced and really specify the actual risks associated with not going to hospital or not getting the care that we're advising them to get. But again, that advice, we need to advise them properly and make sure we leave them in the best situation we can, considering all things.
Absolutely, Matt. Phenomenal, Matt. And look, I mean, patient autonomy, probably the single most important thing in this entire topic. It seems like the perfect place to leave it.
This is a really tricky part of our practice. You know, there's been if I reflect back on some of the more challenging jobs I've been to, it's been around this stuff and navigating the patient who doesn't want to necessarily engage in the care that we're advising and trying to figure out what is the best path for them and making sure that we're doing everything right by the patient. You know, I've had situations whereby taking the patient to hospital would require a procedural sedation and restraint in order to get them to there. And there's a huge amount of risk to that, and that could likely potentially kill them because of their disease process. But also by leaving them there, they could also die as well. And how do you navigate what is the greater of two evils? You know, and that's really tricky. So don't think that this is an easy thing to do. This is a challenging part of your practice. You're not always going to get it right. Just reflect on these decisions. Take your time. There's no rush. If you sit down with someone for an hour or so at their home to try and figure this out, that's fine. Everything else can wait. Your priority at that time is that patient. And if you invest that time, that extra time in getting the right solution for your patient, that is good investment, right? Take your time, get buy-in, you know, read up about some of the background legislation around it, and you'll be good at this stuff. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Nick. Absolutely awesome, my friend. I'm stoked.
Awesome. Hey, guys, if you have any topics for us that you would like us to talk about on the What Would You Do If series, please reach out to us. You can find us on social media. I think we're on Instagram and Facebook, or you can find us on the interwebs, www.theshiftextension.org. But until next time, see you later.